Hello, before we start today's ADA audio conference session, we will do a quick sound check with our speaker. Julie, if you could do a sound check for me, please.
Yes, hello. Can everybody hear me?
Very good. Thanks, Julie. Bridget,
okay.
We can go ahead and get the session underway. Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead. A session's being recorded. Great. Okay.
One second, Julie. Yep.
Oh, I'm
Bridget,
sorry.
Bridget, go ahead with your introduction.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for holding and welcome to the Accessible Polling Facility and the ADA conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any assistance during the conference, please press star, then 0. I would now like to turn the hand the conference over to your host today, Mr. Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center. Thank you, and please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Bridget, and welcome everyone to the March ADA Audio Conference series. For those of you, happy St. Patrick's Day out there. This program is brought to you by the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. The ADA Audio Conference is the longest-running educational program of the network, so we're pleased that you are able to join us today. You can locate the regional ADA center that serves your state by visiting adata.org, or you can give your center a call at 800-949-4232. So we are glad that you are here with us today. We have some great information and a wonderful speaker to bring that information to you. It is timely. We are in the midst of primary season, and more importantly, we have a big general election in the fall, and ensuring that people with disabilities have access to polling facilities and the ability to cast votes independently as all other Americans is critical. So we are pleased to have with us Julie Brinkhoff. Julie is the co-director and principal investigator with the Great Plains ADA Center, another of the 10 regional ADA centers. They are located, the Great Plains ADA Center is located at the University of Missouri. So following Julie's presentation, there will be time for questions for folks, participants to ask questions. For those of you in the webinar room, you can submit your questions while the session is ongoing, and we will get to those once Julie has gone through her presentation. So thanks again for joining us, everyone, today. And at this time, I would like to welcome Julie and turn it over to you.
Thanks. Excuse me. I have allergies, so I'll just make that clear right now. You'll hear a little bit of coughing. I'm being joined by Mike Edwards, who has considerable experience with surveying polling places, and so he's here to really kind of help me out with the facility part of this. And I want to say that when we're saying ADA requirements for accessible polling places and accessible voting, what I'm going to be referring to is specifically guidance that the DOJ put out, or a technical assistance, I should say, that the Department of Justice put out on accessible polling places. And this guidance was basically developed in 2016, so it is relatively current, I would say. And it has the information that I'll be presenting along with an actual checklist that we highly recommend you use if you're surveying a polling place. Then I'm also going to talk a little bit about some best practices related to Election Day and actually serving people with disabilities and things that you should be doing to train your poll staff, your poll workers, and just in general, maybe some things that you can have on hand in case emergencies come up, and they can, or situations come up. And that being said, I'm going to move forward to my next slide, which kind of gets into what I just said. But when we're talking about an accessible facility for voting, we're not talking about an accessible facility that meets the 2010 standards or the 2010 ADA standards for accessible design with complete accessibility. What we're talking about are certain areas or certain features that we want to meet those ADA standards for accessible design or the 2010 standards. And the primary features are parking, the accessible route, ramps and curb ramps, doors and interior access, and signage. Now, of course, having a completely accessible facility would be a best practice, and you may decide that that's what you want. But in terms of what is actually required to provide to your voting public, it is those features that I just mentioned. And I want to really iterate one thing. When you're evaluating that polling place, think of this as a temporary event. In other words, we tend to think of temporary events like festivals, things of that nature, but Election Day really is a temporary event in the sense that you're going to be using buildings designed for a completely different purpose for voting. So when you're looking at that building and determining its accessibility, keep that in mind. You may very well be using a different entrance than the building's main entrance because of where that voting area is. You may want to move that accessible parking and create more spots because you want to have the accessible parking closer to that different entrance. You're certainly going to have signage showing how people are going to be using that building on Election Day. So I'm just going to caution you to keep that in mind when you're looking at a facility. So now let's get into these features. And the first feature I'm going to talk about is parking. And with parking, if you're providing any kind of parking for your voting public, you know, for people that will be coming into that facility to vote, then you also need to provide accessible parking. If you're not providing any parking whatsoever for that facility, then you don't need to provide accessible parking. Remember, when I say you don't need to provide, that means it's not a requirement. I'm not saying don't provide. Anybody is encouraged as a best practice to go above and beyond minimums, but I'm going to be talking about requirements. And of course, if you have parking, then you definitely need to have an accessible parking. So when we're talking about that accessible parking place, we're going to be looking at three elements. So we're going to be looking at the actual parking space where the car or van, you know, is parked. And then we need an access aisle adjacent to that space, and then we need signage designating it as an accessible space. So you have to have those three elements. The other thing I'll add, I think should be added, another element is the actual surface that we're parking on. You want to make sure that surface is as level and stable as possible. So I think it's common sense. We're not going to put our accessible parking on a hill that has a big cross slope and it's gravel. That doesn't make any sense, even if it's really close. So I'm going to move forward and talk a little bit about those actual dimensions. And I've got a nice graphic here, I think, or illustration that the U.S. Access Board put together. And you can see a standard parking space is 96 inches. And our parking space where we're having the, for the accessible parking, is that same 96 inches, but we're also adjacent to us adding the 60 inches minimum for the access aisle. And that's just critical. You have to have that access aisle, and it has to be 60 inches minimum because that's what people need who are wheelchair users to get in and out of the vehicle, not only to have enough room to do it, but to do so safely. Notice on the far or the right side of the illustration, I have the van accessible parking space. And here we have 132 inches minimum width. And the access aisle is that same 60 inches. So the actual parking space for van accessible parking, I should say, is larger than the standard parking size. So we want 132 inch minimum, and we have this access aisle of 60-inch minimum. Now, let's say that we wanted to create more spaces, and I've got the next illustration shows that. And also, of course, you're not all going to memorize all these dimensions that I'm throwing out, and that's why you have this PowerPoint. And I put a lot of slides in here that you can use as resources for yourself at future dates.
Okay.
All right. And as I'm moving forward, so here's an example of a shared access aisle. So we're creating two accessible spaces out of three existing parking spaces. So let's say I have three regular parking spaces, but I need some accessible spaces. And how can I do that the most efficiently? And so here we have our access aisle, and then I have two standard spaces reserved for someone as accessible parking. And so they can both use this. So basically, out of three regular parking spaces, I was able to create two accessible spaces. Now, note the other element I talked about is you have to have the signage. And here I have the International Symbol of Accessibility showing reserved parking, and that's what you want. And notice these signs are posted, and the bottom of the sign where the text is should definitely be 60 inches from the ground or whatever surface this post is coming up from. So basically, that needs to be 60 inches above, and that's your minimum. And most, if you go out and get materials and find signs and find posts, you'll find that most of these are standardized to be correct, to be 60 inches. But if something doesn't look right or you have an existing facility and it looks too low, you know, that's the time to get out your tape measure and make sure that these are the correct height. And then just here's the other note is that, again, because you're very well going to be using other entrances to your building, the main entrance, to that entrance, especially at large facilities. Think of schools, grocery stores. Those are large buildings. You're not going to use that whole facility for voting. So you'll probably have a marked off area for the voting area. And then whatever entrance you're using for that, that's where you want your accessible parking. So you may be creating a different accessible parking area, even if that facility has ample accessible parking, but it's in the wrong location. And we'll get into accessible route and signage more. But of course, if you're creating a separate or a different accessible parking area, then you want to make sure that you have ample signage alerting all your voters as to where that accessible parking is. Here is an illustration, again, coming from DOJ technical assistance materials, and about the accessible route. And what I really, really like about this illustration is that all of the, not all, but so many of the features here are temporary. So we have a facility that's being used, and in order to make it accessible, we're adding a lot of temporary elements to do so. And I want to stress that this is perfectly okay. There's no problem with doing this as long as those temporary elements meet the guidelines set forth by the 2010 standards. You can do this. And the reason I want to really emphasize that is that I know that for various reasons, there might be difficulty finding enough polling places. I know that we've been working in our region with the state of Nebraska, and they've had a number of polling places that they've used in the past that they can't use anymore due to the flooding and basically natural disasters that they've experienced. I know right now, in the city of Chicago, I've been told that with primaries, that a number of polling places that were supposed to be or used to be in nursing homes or senior facilities are being moved because that's definitely not a good place to have your voting. So when you have to move and find different places, you might have to be creative. And the law lets you be creative. That flexibility is put in there by using these temporary measures. So I don't want anyone to feel like if you can't find a building that's perfectly accessible or you don't have time to make it permanently accessible, that you can't use that building. There are other measures you can use. If it seems like I'm moving along here at a breakneck speed, it's because I have a lot of slides for a short period of time. And again, this is to make sure that you have a lot of reference information after I conclude this presentation. And there'll be some slides that I'll just be going through, and they're just, you know, going past, and they're just there for you in terms of reference materials. So bear with me, a lot of material, but I do want to get through as much of it as I can. So what is, when I say accessible route, and I showed the illustration, but what is an accessible route? And it's basically that continuous, unobstructed, very important, unobstructed path that connects all your accessible elements. So essentially, when we're going to our voting, or we're going to vote, we're going to get off someplace. We're either going to start it in the parking lot. We could be starting it, if we're a pedestrian, at the sidewalk that leads up to the building. We could be starting at a very near bus stop. And then we'll be moving from that starting point along some type of walkway to the facility, then to the entrance, and then to the actual voting area. And all of that accessible route I'm talking about needs to be accessible. And so when we say accessible, we mean that we want it to be free of abrupt changes in level. We want it to be as level as possible. We don't want any abrupt changes in the level, and I've got some photos that illustrate that. We don't want steps. We don't want high thresholds, and we certainly don't want steeply sloped walkways. And that refers to both running slope or the vertical slope, and it also refers to cross slope. So, you know, level as possible. Then, now I've been talking about something being level and not having steps or slopes, we also have to have our width. And that accessible route should be at least 36 inches wide. Now, there are some times when you can briefly narrow to 32 inches. So here you get a little wiggle room here if things aren't perfect, and we know that it's hard to always make things perfect. So it can briefly narrow to 32 inches, but only for 2 feet, 24 inches. So you get a 2 feet that you can briefly move into that 32 inches. But really, in terms of accessible route, you should be thinking 36 inches wide. And that's everywhere. That's both outside, that's the walkway, that's inside, and that's in that voting area. And this next slide kind of reiterates what I said. One thing that you want to remember is accessible passenger drop-off sites. If you have an area where people can be dropped off and then they come into the building to vote, that's part of that accessible route too, for those individuals. And that accessible passenger drop-off site might be even closer to the building or slightly different than where your accessible parking is. And I certainly think that if you have an accessible passenger drop-off site, don't say, oh, well, they can just move into the accessible parking, drop the person off and back out and leave and then maybe come back. Because what are you doing? You're tying up your accessible parking for other people. So you should think about that accessible drop-off site as something separate from your accessible parking. Do you concur with that, Mike? I'm going to ask you if I got that one right. Okay, Mike agrees, so that's how we're going to do this. And then here's another very, very important point. Sometimes you're not going to be able to have an accessible route that works for
Julie,
everybody.
I'm going to interrupt you there for 1 second.
Sure.
The capture has lost their connection at this point, so I'm going to have you pause while we get the capture reconnected. Thank you.
That's fine. Let me know when I should start up again.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Bridget, our captioner is going to be calling in on the telephone, so if you could pick up and connect our captioner so we can resume.
Not a problem. Will they be dialing in on a speaker line?
On a participant line.
Participant. Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks, everyone, for having some audio issues with the webinar platform. There's some connectivity issues, so appreciate your patience. And, Julie, thanks for holding on here while we reconnect our captioner.
No problem.
Pardon me, Mr. Berg.
Yes.
I have several people that are redialing back in, and I've answered a couple. I see one more, so I'm going to grab them to try to see if that's them. What's
the captioner?
Name?
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, Mr. Berg, she's back in the room.
Okay, thank you, Bridget.
You're welcome.
Do a sound check for our captioner at this time.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. And, Julie, you can resume there. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to finish up. We were talking about the accessible route on this slide that you, slide 22, you have in front of you. And I have a note, and this is a really critical thing to take in consideration. If you're going to have an accessible route that's different from your general path, in other words, that most of the voters are going to be using one route, but there's no way that you can make it accessible. That route either leads to an entrance that you can't make accessible and you have to use another accessible entrance, or it's just not quite level enough, and so you're going to create another type of route. But whenever you have an accessible route that's different from the general path, you definitely have to have signs that direct voters to both the accessible route and the voting area. So you just want to make sure that you have that sign correctly, and that sign should start from the very beginning of the accessible route. What you want to avoid is people taking all the time and energy to get to a door, then find that they can't use that door, then they have to try to figure out where they want to go. And I think just common sense, you know, it makes sense in terms of common sense. But sometimes when you have people doing your access surveys and you're kind of making your plans, that can get forgotten. This is the interior accessible route. I think that speaks for itself. And like I said, I'm going to be moving through some of these slides pretty quickly so we can get through the material and you have the slides for future reference. But mainly is that you're going to be getting through the door. And then, you know, how you're going through that voting area. You're probably going to have people going to the registration sign-in and then to the actual voting tables, ballot marking devices, whatever you're using, and then back out of the building. And as we said earlier or established, that's 36 inches. That's what you need to have that maneuvering space to get through the area. We'll talk about doors a little bit later. Note on this picture, and I'm using my clicker pointer, and I know you can't see that. Note on this picture, though, that there's a chair by the door. That's a really nice gesture for people who may have fatigue or just, you know, whatever type of disability could make it difficult for them to stand for periods of time. So that chair is, again, it's a best practice, not required. I really went through this slide when I talked about the passenger drop-off locations when I was talking about accessible route. But just remember, when you have a passenger drop-off, then it needs to be accessible or have that access aisle and all the features of accessible parking that you would have for accessible parking place. You're just remembering that you're basically reserving it for passenger drop-off and not considering it to be part of your accessible parking. So now I'm going to get into curb ramps. And Mike, feel free to jump in on curb ramps because this isn't, you know, my area of expertise. But a curb ramp or a curb cut is different than a ramp, as in it's just for, you'll commonly see a curb ramp when someone is going from the street to the sidewalk because, of course, what you have there is the curb, which is essentially a step to get to the sidewalk. And so to make that accessible, we're going to have to ramp that. But what you're talking about is a much smaller ramp, and it has some different standards that we use. Now, a curb ramp can be no steeper than that 1 in 12, the 1 inch of rise for every 12 inches of run, and that's the same as a regular ramp. It's just going to look different because we're talking about a much smaller area. But no steeper than 1 in 12. That's your maximum. And, of course, you can have it to go 1 in 14, 1 in 18. You know, that's great. But 1 in 12 is your maximum that you can go. Then you can have flared sides. And if you notice in this illustration, and this comes from guidance from the U.S. Access Board, we have sides, flared sides, and those can be 1 in 10. So they can be a little bit steeper than the actual part that people will be using to walk across or to go up onto that sidewalk. So there's our standard curb ramp that we already have. So if you're looking at a curb ramp, that's what you want to make sure that you have, that it's no steeper than the 1 in 12, and if it has flared sides, that can be 1 in 10. And I'm going to move on, though, to portable curb ramps. So often you'll have situations where, can we use this place at all? How do we make an accessible route because we have these problems? And here's where portable curb ramps can be really helpful. Now, I want you to notice on these portable curb ramps, they don't have the flared sides. So what we have is edge protection. If you notice on either side of that portable curb ramp, we have an edge that comes up. And I think that's for an obvious reason. We don't want someone stepping off of that, you know, it's to make it safer. So we've got that on that curb portable curb ramp. Something you want to keep in mind with a portable curb ramp is that it is sturdy enough to handle a power wheelchair. So you can, if you buy one, make absolutely sure that you're looking at its, you know, product specifications, and this is something that can handle the weight of a power chair. Portable curb ramps, or sometimes just really thick mats, can also be used when we have sidewalk problems. And here I have an image that I think shows a pretty typical sidewalk problem where you'll get into areas where the sidewalk is crumbling, it's not level, we've got these problems. A curb ramp can actually be used in these kinds of situations too. So I'm moving on to ramps. You can see I have lots of examples of portable because that's where when you're trying to add something and to fix a problem to know how this is going to work. Portable ramps are okay. They're perfectly fine, but they have to meet the exact specifications that the 2010 standard sets forth for permanent ramps. So, and that accounts for exterior and interior. But whenever that slope is getting greater than 1 in 20, and that's 1 inch for 20 inches, 1 inch rise for every 20 inches, I should say, it's considered a high enough slope for a ramp, and so then you need to ramp that area. Now, the picture that I'm using here is a step. So we have slope, and that is your actual, you know, walkway, and when that slope or that, you know, starts to turn into a hill, essentially, is 1 in 20. But sometimes we have steps. I shouldn't say sometimes. I'll say if you have steps, then you also have to have a ramp. And even if it's one step and even if it's a short step, you need to have a ramp for people to be able to get to the next level or into a building. And I've got a really good illustration here that basically has all of the dimensions and the features of a ramp. And I just want to real quickly point out two things that people need to keep in mind when they're putting in a portable ramp or looking at your existing ramp, and that's landings, because landings are critical. You can have everything you need in terms of making sure that that ramp meets, you know, the maximum level allowed, which is the 1 in 12, but you definitely have to have a level landing at the bottom so people have a level flat area to be on when they're before they get onto the ramp, and then as someone is leaving the ramp, they have a level flat area when they leave the ramp, and especially if that ramp is leading to a doorway. Because can you imagine trying to get into a door? You're having to pull the door open, and you don't have a level area to do that from. If you were actually at the top of the ramp trying to do it, you know, when you're basically not on a level area and you're essentially on a slope that's 1 to 12, that's going to be almost impossible to do.
Yeah.
So
it cut off on me.
Hello? And anyway, and then I've got other things about handrails. If the rise is greater than 6 feet, then you're going to need to have handrails on both sides. So basically use this as reference, but here's everything that you need to have for ramps. And then I also have these ramp specifications again. So for those of us that like our information visually, I have the illustration. And for those of us kind of like me who like the information to be written out in bullet points, I have it this way as well. So your dimensions for your ramps. Mike, do you have anything to add to ramps?
Not really. With that level landing, keep in mind the handrails that you've got on there should also extend 12 inches on both the top and the bottom into that level landing to help somebody kind of get themselves, you know, straightened back out and prepare for whatever's next.
Oh.
So you should have those handrail extensions at the top and bottom, like you're showing.
Mike
here
is here.
Picture.
Yeah, and thank you for adding that, because it shows in the picture, but I didn't say why. And that's why the extensions are there, because, again, you're going to need to be able to grab onto that ramp at that level area before you get to it, and then as you're getting off of it, you need that support. So that's really critical. So thanks for I knew I'd forget something.
Julie and
yeah.
Mike, if you could just get a little closer to the speakerphone when you comment, we want to make sure we hear you. Thanks.
Okay. Sure. Can you hear me all right, Peter?
Yes.
Okay, great. Building entrance. Okay, a polling place must have at least one accessible entrance. I think that kind of makes sense. Everything I've said about accessible routes would be, of course, we have to have an accessible entrance. And when we're saying an accessible entrance, we mean that doorway or the part of the door that someone is actually passing through, there needs to be a minimum clear width of 32 inches. And so by clear width, what I'm talking about is when that door is completely opened, we have to have 32 inches that someone can pass through. So if you have a door that doesn't quite open all the way, you know, you can measure between your interior door frames and get 32 inches. But if the actual door doesn't completely open for whatever reason, then you don't have a clear space of 32 inches. So that's just something to really keep in mind. Also, you want to look at thresholds. That if that threshold is very high, and I believe it's over a quarter of an inch, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you have a threshold that's over a quarter of an inch high, then you're really going to have some difficulty for people to get through. And you can fix this by just having what's called a portable curb threshold ramp, and you can find these and get them and install them. And then you must have signs directing people to this accessible entrance. And if you have an entrance that's not accessible, even on that doorway, it's not accessible, but it has to have a sign that's going to direct people to the accessible entrance. And then the accessible entrance needs to have a sign showing that it's the accessible entrance. So that's what we want with our doorways, or our building entrance, I should say. And here's an example. I have a photo of a person who's a wheelchair user, and notice how she's coming up to the door. Notice that there's going to be enough clear space because she can open the door all the way, and she has a nice flat entrance area, so it's easy for her to pull back when she's opening that door. But the added dimension to this in terms of opening the door is the door opening force. So with interior doors, you don't want more than 5 pounds of force to open that door. And with an exterior door, I don't really have the requirements, but in terms of a best practice, I would say no more than 8 pounds of force. So what do you do if you've measured your doors and you've used a door pressure gauge and you found out that you have a lot of force? What can you do? Well, one thing that's recommended is on election day, just prop that door open. But if you prop a door open, first of all, you want to make sure it's wide enough that you have, again, that clear space of 32 inches, and that you keep it propped open during the entire voting time. So we aren't opening, closing. That's the accessible entrance, and it's too heavy for someone to open on their own, then we want to make sure we have it open. I want to add something else, too, about this door opening force. That's going to affect a lot more people than just individuals who are wheelchair users. We're thinking of building accessibility, but this is also going to affect people who, for whatever reason, maybe have limited strength and can't open those doors. So I think in terms of best practice, in terms of accessibility, that door opening force should apply to all entrances that anyone is using, not just that accessible route. Because you may very well have someone with a disability who's not a wheelchair user using that main entrance that's not the accessible route, but when they get to the door, they can have a really difficult time because of the weight of that door. Going to move on. And then we get into, we've talked about getting through the door, being able to open the door in terms of the weight of the door or the pressure of the door, but then we get into the actual door hardware. And what you want to make sure you don't have is that standard doorknob that someone has to actually open their hand, wide open, grasp, pinch, and turn, because this is very difficult for people with a number of disabilities. And I have examples. This is coming from the U.S. Access Board of the kind of handles that are okay and that people with different types of disabilities can use. And I'm not going to go into each one. I think they speak for themselves there. But the thing you can see is for each one of those, we don't necessarily have to have a hand that's widely opened and there's no grasping motion that's necessary. And again, I've talked about accessible route, but this is something that can affect people with a wide range of disabilities. And so we're really talking about all of our doors. In order to meet the needs of people with as many disabilities as possible. So both for exterior and interior, you want to make sure you're not using those kinds of handles that require the twisting and pulling. And if you can't find something to temporarily fix this, there are portable little lever grips that you can put on doors, different things you can do. You can always prop that door open. Protruding objects, okay. Protruding objects, so we're kind of moving, it's still part of the accessible route, but we're kind of getting from the needs of wheelchair users to the needs of different kinds of people who, may have disabilities. And so this is mainly is for individuals who are blind or very low vision. And a protruding object is essentially anything that's going to protrude, I'm just going to say stick out, more than 4 inches from the wall. So we have something, and a fire extinguisher is a very common example of something that's sticking out more than 4 inches from the wall, and it's located between the that 27 inches and 80-inch range. So when I'm saying 27 inches, I mean 27 inches from the floor and 80 inches in general. So If it's higher than 80 inches, it's going to be okay. If it's lower than 27 inches from the floor, it's going to be okay. And why is it okay if it's lower than 27 inches from the floor? It's because the cane sweep can detect that object. Why is it okay if it's higher than 80 inches? Because we're talking about an incredibly tall individual if 80 inches is a problem. So what we're looking at is that 27-80 range and jutting 4 inches out from the wall. And I've got my example here because fire extinguishers are very, very common. So let's say you have a fire extinguisher in the hallway. Do you have to take it down? What should you do? And the really simple fix is just to put a planter, you know, an object like a heavy clay pot on the floor underneath that fire extinguisher, because then the cane is going to be able to detect that, or the cane sweep can detect that object that's below the protruding object. So that's your fix. So you really don't have to do a lot of reconfiguring, spend a lot of money. Just have that object that you can put below it that works for the cane sweep. And here's another thing to keep in mind, and that's the underside of open stairs. And I think you can tell from the illustration at the bottom of this slide why this is such a hazard. Basically, we have not only an accessibility hazard, but a risk management hazard. And so how we handle that is, again, putting up a barrier. And in this case in the illustration, what we've used is some fencing. But you'll see this commonly in hotels, where a hotel will put some seating in that area, or maybe large planters in that area. Anything in that area to keep someone from continuing to move forward and then hitting their head on the underside of those stairs. So if you have something like that, you really want to pay attention to it. Now, one thing I want to add to protruding objects that I think is very, well, it's not, I think it is very important. It is very important. Blind individuals or individuals with low vision may use a route other than the accessible route. If you have two different routes, you're going to want to make sure that protruding objects are assessed and that's eliminated, that barrier is eliminated on all routes that you have to the voting area and through the voting area, all of those, because a blind individual may use the general route, a blind individual may use the accessible route. So look for protruding objects in all routes to the voting area. And we're getting, now we're at the voting area. And I've kind of said all of this before, but I want to add something else. And this is something that you definitely want to make sure that your poll staff who are there on that, you know, that particular voting day are aware of. And those are the little kind of things that get moved around that can cause problems with the accessible route or problems for anyone. And that's trash cans. The last time you looked at the voting area, there may not have been trash cans in the way of the door swing. But over the course of the day, trash cans can get moved, or maybe janitorial staff move the trash cans. So you want to make sure that you don't have those kinds of objects that can be moved around in the way, and that your staff know if they see something that's in the way, that that can be moved. Little rugs, anything that can pose a tripping hazard of that, you know, should be taken care of. Alert your staff if they maybe see a cord or something that's a problem. Having some duct tape available to duct tape that down and duct tape over it is a really good idea. So essentially what I'm saying is give that, you know, over the course of election day, things won't stay in the same place. And your staff should know to kind of continually be monitoring that and making sure that we keep that clear floor space. And actual voting machines or voting, you know, places where people actually cast their ballot. And I really like this picture because it shows a good example. I see a note from Melissa. Thanks, Melissa. I see a good example of universal design because a lot of people can vote in a lot of different ways. Notice that one individual is standing, and this person, for a variety of reasons, may prefer to stand, but disability could be one of the reasons. Another person is voting the way most of us do. We sit down. at that table and mark our ballot. But very easily, just by pulling the chair aside, we now have an accessible area to vote. And notice that we have the universal symbol of accessibility indicating that this is an accessible table. And so the wheelchair user can easily pull up to and under the table and vote. Person leaves, we can push a chair back in, and another individual can use it. So you've got a lot of, I just think it's a really good example of universal design, where we have one type of voting station, but many different people can use it in many different ways. If you are using, and you should be, because this is part of it, a ballot marking device, I know that there are a lot of different companies out there, different states and different counties are choosing different types of voting machines, so to speak. So that's why I'm using that term, voting machine. But you want to make sure whatever you use, that the operable part is never higher than 48 inches. That's really, really important. That operable part has to be no higher than 48 inches. Okay. I'm seeing a lot of comments on this, so I'll try to get through this pretty fast, and those can be good for questions or to add. And, of course, I'm not getting every single thing in here because of the limited amount of time that we have. This could be a whole half day just spent talking about this. Okay. Temporary signage. This is going to be necessary, again, because you're using that facility for a different activity than you normally do. So be prepared. All your buildings, you should have some type of temporary signage because you're trying to tell individuals where they should vote and alerting them as to the accessible routes, which doorways accessible, accessible parking. And so all of those signs are generally not there when the building is being used for its normal purposes. So you're going to be bringing that signage in. And you do not have to follow the ADA standards for signage, but you should try to follow the specifications for directional signs as closely as you possibly can. But you aren't required to meet that completely because these are temporary signs. But some quick things, if you're using a temporary sign and you're looking into purchasing some, the simpler the design, the better. You know, really simple design. And that's really universal, a universal design principle. And you don't want extended or condensed type. The other thing you want to make sure you have is very high contrast. So notice that the sign that's in this image, we have white against a dark blue or a royal blue, and then we have red against white. So again, we have a lot of contrast between the background and the text, and that's what you want. The next, along with that high contrast, you also want a non-glare finish. I know if you're having things printed up and that, you know, high gloss laminate might look really, really nice and snappy, but it's going to create a glare, and that glare can make it very difficult for people to read that sign, especially as they're approaching it from a distance. And common sense says your character should be sized according to the viewing distance. So if you're wanting people who are maybe pulling up in their car to notice something, you're going to want, you know, pretty big fonts. You're going to want a fairly large sign. If this is just a sign that's on the door and people will see it when they get to the door, then that's going to make somewhat of a difference. And you are allowed, if you have an existing room sign, but it's difficult to read or there are just problems with it, you can put a temporary sign over that sign. If it's possible to do that, you can do that. So don't feel that you're bound by existing signage. You know, if it says main entrance here, and that's what's always been used at that particular facility, but that's not going to serve your purposes, then, you know, you can just put a sign over it because that would make it less confusing than having two signs. And I think that this pretty much speaks for itself. The other thing, I don't know who would use make a cursive sign anymore because it seems like all of us have forgotten how to write in cursive. But if you're having to make a hand-lettered sign, and sometimes situations come up where you're needing to reroute people on election day, you need to make a quick hand-lettered sign, then always use printing. Never use cursive, just because, for obvious reasons. And again, when only some routes are accessible, you're going to want to make sure, besides the text, that you have that international sign of accessibility. That is the clue, that is the icon that's going to tell people that this is the direction that I should be going. Okay. Oh boy, we're really going through this time. I'm going to skip this particular slide because I think the point I want to get across is better put on this building or this image. So here we have an image of a church, and this church has three separate entrances, two that are accessible, one that's not accessible. And it's really critical that we indicate which, from the street level, so if someone is seeing that building, they would know immediately which way they should go and which accessible entrance should be used to get into the voting area. So if the voting area, let's say, is in the center of the building and it's going to be equal distance from either entrance and you're wanting to use both of those entrances, then you should mark both of those entrances. But let's say we really want to route people with only one of the entrances, then we indicate which entrance is our accessible voting route. So just because it's an accessible entrance doesn't mean we're going to mark that as so. What we want to show is this is our accessible entrance for the voting route today. So that's why you'll see signs that say accessible voting here, because it would be really easy for someone to think, well, that's an accessible entrance, or it could already be marked as such on the building. So again, accessible voting entrance, and this is the accessible route to accessible voting, to make that really, really clear whenever you have a building that has more than one accessible entrance. And I talked about handmade signs. Obviously, someone did a quick fix because people weren't going the right way, and I think that's a great way to do it. You know, they put a sign there, and so someone is pulling up to that parking space, and they immediately know which direction to go. But I would add, I would have put the sign maybe, you know, to the side of this so I'm not getting into that 60-inch clearance. Also note that this sign is on the building. You can do that. If the parking spot pulls right up to the building, then you don't necessarily have to put the sign on the post. You can have the sign on the building. You just need to make sure that you're still following that 60 inches from the ground or sidewalk or pavement, you know, from the bottom space, that 60-inch minimum. Okay. Do you want to take over on this one, Mike, or you want me to keep going?
I can if you want me to.
Yeah, I've been talking like crazy.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to let Mike do this one. This part, because he has done so many of these accessibility surveys. This is basically tips, and this is coming out of the Department of Justice.
Okay, so we're going to do an accessibility survey of our building. So we're actually going to go out and look at it and make sure, you know, find out where the accessible route is. And here's some of the things we would probably need here. One, I would, you know, suggest a tape measure that's at least 20 feet long. You know, you're going to want to measure parking spaces that are at least 16 feet wide, you know, for a van parking space. So I would get a tape, nice heavy-duty tape measure that's at least 20 feet long. A soft tape measure works well, like the more the tailor's tape, to be able to wrap around a handrail and make sure that meets the requirements for the dimensions of those handrails. A level. You can use a bubble level, but I would highly recommend getting a digital level if you can. It's so much easier. It saves you a lot of time. And if you're like me, you don't like to do math, so it'll tell you right immediately what the slope of that is. We recommend using a 24-inch level. That is the same length of a level that the Department of Justice would use if they were coming in to do an accessibility survey. So we normally recommend a 24-inch long level. A door pressure gauge. These are pretty simple devices. You press them up against the door, and once the door starts swinging, you kind of measure how much pressure that is. It's normally kind of a spring-loaded object, and it just it presses against it, and you can read right on it, you know, how much pressure you're using there. These are pretty simple. You know, they only cost maybe 10, 15 bucks, so they're pretty easily you can get them just about anywhere. A digital camera with a flash and spare batteries. You can also use a camera phone, but I always take photos of every barrier that I find so I can write it up, you know, in a report later so I know what I have. And then especially if I'm handing that off to somebody else to make a fix or whatever, then they know exactly what I was talking about when I wrote down that barrier. Clipboards and pens and pencils, obviously, you know, to write down whatever you find there. Door stops for keeping doors open during measurements. I don't have you're going to have to click forward for me.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay, so for measuring and recording, one person can complete a survey of a polling place, but it's often quicker and easier if two people work together. So in this case, I would normally have one person taking the measurements, the other person taking the photos and writing those dimensions down. You can get through a building pretty quickly with two people a lot faster than you can with by yourself. By all means, if it's just you, you can do it yourself, but a second person is definitely helpful. Go ahead. All right. For slope surfaces, when measuring the slope of a ramp, parking space, pedestrian route, it is important to identify whether the surface is accessible. And then two slope measurements perpendicular to one another should be taken at each location. One is the running slope, which runs parallel to the direction of travel. That one, you know, should be no more than a 1 to 20, and then it becomes a ramp up to a 1 to 12. You also want to look, and this is really crucial, look at the cross slope. That's your side-to-side slope. That really should be no more than 2% either way, that way, because once you start getting higher cross slopes, 3, 4, 5%, they start getting really, really dangerous. So you'll want to fix those slopes. All right. Yeah, you moved it.
too quickly.
The easiest way to measure slope, like we said, is a digital level. The digital display gives a reading that's shown as a ratio, either a percentage or a degree. Normally, I always keep it at a percentage, and that way I can tell exactly what it is. Anything above 5% becomes a ramp, and a 1 in 12 slope, which is the maximum of a ramp, is 8.33%. Go ahead. Another way to measure slope is using a 24-inch level with the leveling bubbles. Like I said, this is the way you have to do some math here. But you can place the level on a slope surface in the direction you wish to measure. Rest one end of the level on the highest point of the slope surface and lift the other end until the bubble is right in the middle. This is the level position. While this level is in position, measure the distance between the bottom end of the level and the slope surface below. If the distance is 2 inches or less, then the slope is a 1 to 12 or less. When the distance is more than 2 inches, you want to record that distance on a checklist so the exact slope can be calculated later. For measuring cross slope, if the distance measured from the level position is 1/2 inch or less, then it's a slope of 1 to 48 or 2% or less. To measure door openings, what you want to do is measure from the latch. You want to open the door to 90 degrees and then measure from the latch side door frame to the door itself when it's open at that 90 degrees. That's going to be your clear width. That has to be at least 32 inches. Go ahead and go to the next one.
Okay.
Okay.
And that kind of does that. And thank you, Mike. Okay. I want to tell everybody I kind of threw this on him, that little section there, just because can you all hear me? I was just wanting a little break on my throat there for a while. But like I said, he has done a lot of surveys, so it's better than I am. Although I do want to add one thing about conducting these surveys, because you're doing it building to building, but then when you're looking at your overall plan, you're looking at your voting, you know, precinct or your county or whatever in an entirety. So you have to come up with some way to handle all this data that you're taking. And if you want to save yourself a lot of grief, I highly recommend that you come up with a consistent way to name your photos, because, you know, you're going to be going through and one sidewalk looks just like another sidewalk, and how do we associate that with the precinct, with a particular voting facility? Where is it? Is it in the front of the building, the back of the building? So make sure that you name your photos and with it consistently come up with some kind of way to do this, and then make sure that you record the information that goes with that photo. And on any recording information, I would put that title that you've given for the photo, you know, the however you're going to name it, on there. And again, just so as you pull all this information together, you know exactly what it is that you're looking at and can use that. I may not be saying that in the best way, but I think you know what I mean. But it's definitely something that you want to sit down and think through, because you're going to have a lot of data to sift through once you do all your accessibility surveys. So here are some additional requirements. I have a little bit about curbside voting. I had a lot more, and I took it out. And the reason for that is in working with Secretary of State offices, I'm finding that they're really looking at this curbside voting and deciding, do we want to do this? Do we not want to do this? And wanting to really come up with their policies as how they want that to work. So there are some specific guidelines that are available as to the minimum that you're supposed to do. But since you're coming from all across the United States, different areas, what I say is, make sure that you know what your particular county and your particular state has set up for guidelines for curbside voting in terms of the procedures, and follow those. If you do have curbside voting, though, you want to make sure that you have the signage that informs voters of the option to vote. And when you pick that location for curbside voting, you want to make sure that it is you know, the flat surface, all of that. But you also want to make sure that it's in a safe area for your polling workers. If people will be coming out to cars, you want to ensure that they're not having to walk against traffic, that they're not standing in front of another parking space so someone could back into them. You know, this seems like, well, duh, of course I would do that. But actually, these things happen. So that's just something to keep in mind. You may have noticed I saw some questions pop up about actual voting machines and voting devices. That's a whole area into itself, and I didn't add it to this presentation because I didn't have the adequate time to cover it. But this is another area where it seems where each state is working with those vendors and providers to make sure that they're getting correct and accessible voting machines that meet the standards that they're supposed to. And then their best practice would be to make sure that all election officials have this information, have the training to know how to use these devices and how to set them up, and they're being consistent from precinct to precinct. Because of the limited time, I'm not going to go through effective communication. I'm going to kind of skip through this section. And this is for your reference, other than to say that effective communication is not just on election day. It is required during all of the voting process. And so that includes registration. That includes your public wanting to get information about voting, you know, where their precinct is, where they will be voting, lost their, you know, they need to have an address change. How do they do that? all of that's communication, and you want to make sure all of that is follows effective communication guidelines. And that, of course, means anything that's on a website should be accessible. So we're talking about websites that meet WCAG version 2, level 2A guidelines at least, but definitely being accessible. I guess now is the time that I will make this announcement. We recently, working with the state of Nebraska, put together a manual that has a lot of this information in it, but more in depth. It's 47 pages, so it's definitely more in depth. And it includes an effective communication checklist. I did this specifically for the state of Nebraska, but I'm working on having another version of that that we can make available. And so I'm hoping to have that sometime in April. And all this information will be available to anybody that wants it in HTML format on a website. So as I skip through effective communication, because there are but I do want to add that here is some best practice that the National Association of the Deaf recommended, and that was on election day, just having some written statements that would be easy, you know, in large enough type, that would be easy for people who read text and want to use text can look at. And so you standardly have that, and they gave some examples. And one was, is your address correct? Sign the registration card. Please show your driver's license or other photo identification. That first line is going to change. Some states, like the state of Nebraska that we worked with, does not even have a photo ID requirement. So, again, don't assume that everything that I'm saying is going to apply to your state, because different states have different requirements. But if your state does have a requirement for photo identification, then, you know, it would be a nice idea to have this information written down to be able to use if someone can't hear, or there could be a variety of reasons that would be helpful. That's a duplicate. Okay. I didn't have on my other thing about my other slide about temporary signage, the international. I think we all know what that looks like, but I wanted to include it at least one time so we could see, when I throw out the term international symbol of accessibility, what I mean. And there it is right there. And it can either be the blue background with the wheelchair icon in front of it, or it can be the wheelchair icon against the light background. But that's what you need to have. Service animals. Can't do any presentation without talking about service animals a little bit. And, of course, service animals, because people use service animals and people are going to vote, and they have every right to bring their service animal with them. The ADA identifies or defines a service animal as a dog, and this dog can be any breed or size, even if the community has breed restrictions. Now, some states may have an expanded definition of a service animal. And if you live in one of those states, then obviously you're going to follow your state guidelines. So if a state allows more than dogs to be service animals, then you may very well be having service animals enter the voting facility that are not dogs. But the ADA sets the minimum standards, and one minimum standard is that we cannot have breed restrictions. So even if your community has a breed restriction, if somebody comes in with a service dog that is a pit bull or a German shepherd, then they have a right to do so under the ADA line. I see someone put service animals can also be a miniature horse. Yes, they can. Miniature horses are not in the definition of a service animal, but they are considered an exception to a service animal, and that is correct. What you want to tell your polling staff is to, if someone comes in with a service dog, not to distract the animal. It's tempting to want to say good boy, or hey, does he want to have a treat, or give him a little pat, or even, you know, whistles and eye contact. It's always tempting to do that, but you don't want to do that because the dog's working and it needs to keep its focus on performing the job. The other thing you want to make sure that your staff know is not to ask for identification. That a dog is a service animal. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't ask if it's a service animal. I'm talking about identification. And the reason you shouldn't ask for identification is there's no identification that is required by the federal government. So dogs aren't required to be certified. They aren't required to be licensed. The handlers or the users of these dogs aren't required to have any type of license or documentation. So none really exists that have any actual meaning. So you just don't ask for that. Also, your staff need to know that service dogs aren't required to wear a vest. So if someone says, this is my service dog and it doesn't have a vest, that's okay. They're not required to do so. If it's not obvious, and I really want to state this, don't be asking people who are wheelchair users who have a service dog with them, or people obviously who are blind and have a service dog with them, if that is indeed a service animal. You know, that's really seen almost to the point of harassment. But if it's not obvious that a dog is a service dog, then your staff can ask two questions. Is your dog a service dog, and what task or work does the dog perform? That's it. Those are the only two questions that may be asked. Your staff should be trained not to ask the dog to perform its task. And the reason for this is performing a task when it isn't needed can really be confusing to the animal and can actually interfere with its training. Now, the one thing that you can do is remove a service animal. People always say, well, if I can't know for sure if it's a service dog or not, how should I know whether it can be in this building? And my response is, in terms of best practice, I would not worry about trying to make absolutely sure that every service dog or service animal that you see in a building is truly a service dog. You'll waste valuable time that people are trying to use to vote, asking questions and maybe getting into a back and forth that there's no way that you can actually prove that information. So what you want to do is to pay attention to the animal's behavior. Because regardless of whether an animal is a service dog or not, I shouldn't say regardless, I should say that service dogs can be removed. And the ADA clearly states that if a dog's handler can't get the dog under control when it's wandering around or bothering other voters, barking, doing some kind of disruptive behavior, if that animal can't quickly be brought under control, you have the right to remove, to ask that the dog be removed from the area or even remove the dog from the area. Obviously, if a dog is aggressive, if we have snapping, snarling, you know, biting, any of those kinds of behaviors, we can have that dog removed immediately. What you need to remember, though, is that the voter has the right to return without the dog. Now, I'm just getting into the bare bones of service dogs with these few slides, but I do think it's critically important that you make sure that the staff that you have in place on election day know about service dogs and know what to expect and have some basic information about that. I'm going to get into modification of policy. The reason I'm bringing this up is you're going to have a lot of volunteers, a lot of different people, and they've spent time learning the procedures and policies. And then all of a sudden you're saying, yeah, but, you know, then you can change policies. Well, when do you do that? That can be a little bit, you know, difficult. And so just make it clear that modification of policy is something that we do in order to remove barriers for people with disabilities. And most of the time, these barriers are very, very simple. And I'm talking about something, and really almost like providing assistance. So if we have a voter with cerebral palsy who's asking for assistance putting a ballot in the ballot box, that's a modification of policy, because you're generally telling, you know, your policy or procedure is that people put their own ballot in the ballot box. When someone is using an approved form of identification that's not a driver's license, when you've said that they can use other forms, that's a modification of policy. If someone asks to have a ballot question read to them, that again is a modification of policy. And my last one I use is that, let's say we're in an area that has a big no food or drink sign, and someone who has low blood sugar is nibbling on a little snack. Letting them do so is a modification of policy. All of these things are kind of like assistance, and people should know that they can do that And without having to get a supervisor or making a big commotion, drawing attention to the individual, just these modifications should just be done simply and easily. And I love this image, label jars, not people. And again, staff and volunteers should make sure that they're never making a decision about whether someone truly has the ability to vote based upon appearances or biases about that individual. So for most of us who are probably involved in this presentation right now, you know, that just seems like common sense. But remember, you're going to be having a lot of people who are getting trained, who are volunteering, that may not have the background with people with disabilities that the rest of us do. And so this is just a good reminder that we can have biases, and many times those biases are based on appearance. I'm going to kind of go through these. You've got this information here. It's reiterating things that I've already said. So I'm going to skip through this. You have it for resources. I do want to say something about accessibility complaints. And complaints are different than requests. A request is such as a modification of policy or just a request for some assistance. But a complaint is when an individual believes that because of the way things are set up or because of something that has happened or didn't happen, that their right to vote was impeded in some way, shape, or form. And when this happens, and this could happen for a variety of reasons beyond accessibility, your poll workers should just know to remain courteous, friendly, follow through on that request, follow your procedures that you've set up for that. You probably have a point person to take this kind of information to, and to remember that it's a person with disability, it's their right to file a complaint if they choose to do so. It's not a personal reflection, and complaints is one way that we improve future voting accessibility. So if that happens, again, let's just be courteous, friendly, and not take it personally. And we're getting close to our time to end, so these things, I just have some quick tips. I think they really, really speak for themselves. And if you would like, I'd rather open this up to questions because I've been seeing all sorts of comments kind of like flashing across my screen. So I know that there are some questions out there. So would you like to do that? I also want to say the quick tips for customer service for polling staff. These make a real nice training materials within themselves. And if you want to use those, like take it out of this presentation if you want, and actually create your own training for your staff, like a disability awareness training, please feel free to do so. That's the intent and purpose for this section. So I'm going to open this up to some questions because we do have some remaining minutes.
All right. Thanks, Julie. And thanks for all the great information, and Mike for pitching in there. For those that did not download the handout prior to the session, when the archive is posted, the handouts will be posted with the archive, so you'll have access to the entire presentation plus all the great resources that Julie has included in her presentation. Before I ask Bridget to give instructions to our phone participants, a couple of questions that came in. Julie and Mike, could you just clarify, there were a lot of questions about the portable curb ramp, and you had mentioned about the weight of a power wheelchair. If you could just talk about those requirements or how the ADA standards address those type of portable temporary ramps.
Do you want to take that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a portable ramp, you know, like you said, should be able to accommodate the different types of chairs. Now, a power wheelchair can be very heavy. They're typically around 300 to 400 pounds, probably. You add the user, you know, sitting in it. So it would really be good if you could find a portable ramp that could hold 500 to 600 pounds, you know, to use. I wouldn't use anything that would hold less than 500 pounds, probably.
Excellent. Thanks. And that's something, right, Mike, that, you know, the folks that are doing that should be working with the vendor and asking, you know, those questions, doing their due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yep. And then the question about slide 18, if you want to go back to that, someone was asking if slide 18, in fact, shows two van accessible spaces because they're sharing a common access aisle there, slide 18.
We go way back.
Slide 18. Okay.
Yeah, I bet I know what they're talking about, too. Can you repeat that, Peter?
Well, someone was asking if slide 18, in fact, showed two van accessible spaces because of the access aisle they were sharing, I think is what the person was asking.
Basically, yeah. In this particular picture, there only one of them has the signage that says van accessible, but there really isn't any difference between the two parking spaces. So essentially, yeah, you do have two van accessible spots there, yes.
And I also want to say, I found this picture, and sometimes it's hard to find good photos, and I liked a lot about it. And the photo said that that's what it was showing, but personally, when I look at it, and I don't know if it's an optical illusion or what, the one parking space for the van doesn't look wider, that much wider than the other one. Would you say so, Mike?
I think it's just the...
And the angle of the photo. Yeah. So I can see why someone would ask that question for sure.
All right, great. And then staying with a parking question. Someone, where'd that one go? Someone was asking, is there a maximum distance that accessible spaces can be from the building or from the entrance?
Can I take that one?
Yeah,
and then you can answer. Okay. You know, you want to get it as close as possible. I'm not aware of a maximum distance as close as possible. But sometimes the closest parking area is not the best parking area because we have to keep safety in mind. So if you don't have that nice level surface close to the main entrance, then you're better off getting as close as you possibly can and still provide a level surface. Because as Mike was saying earlier about cross slope, when you get into any kind of cross slope on any kind of surface, then you're really increasing risk of injury, and you do not want to do that. So definitely you want to get as close as possible, but never at the expense of safety. So you might have to move that accessible parking maybe a little bit farther away than you thought you would for that particular reason.
Excellent. Thank you. And then there was a comment. Julie, could you clarify how the ADA standards address opening force for exterior doors?
You want to take that one, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the 2010 standards actually don't have a requirement for the pounds force for an exterior door. Our country is so large that you can't really put that on there because weather patterns are completely different in different parts of the country. We did a recommendation of 8 pounds force, but there may be some areas in the country where the wind is so strong that could rip the door right off its hinges. So you may have to go a little heavier. That 8 pounds force was just a best practice recommendation to try to get it close in there. Interior doors have a 5 pounds force maximum, but exteriors do not because of weather patterns. But we still need to try to get those as less as possible. Now, if you have to do a really heavy door, you may end up having to station somebody there to mm-hmm. open it if someone comes by.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's a great point. The bottom line is that folks need to be able to get into the building. So it goes to what you were talking about, Julia, you know, modifying your policies and procedures and providing
mm-hmm.
assistance. I mean, you could even have a door that's at 8 pounds and someone still may not be able to open it independently.
Correct.
And one thing you want to avoid in terms of practice if you do that is having a sign that says, if you need assistance getting in, call this number. We're not assuming that everybody has their cell phone, and so you don't want to use that. So if you're having a door and it's closed, let's say you can't prop it open because of wind or whatever, and you want it closed, then you're going to have to station someone who knows when to open that door for people that can't do it themselves. But avoid the call this number, and somebody will run to the door and let you in. You don't want to do that.
Right, great. Julie, do you want to comment on the comment? You talked about using something to make an element, make an object detectable. And someone had pointed out that if the element that that is protruding is something that it needs to be accessible, you know, there may be some things that you want to watch if you're going to use a, you know, a planter or some other piece of equipment or furniture to make that detectable.
Well, you want to make sure that it doesn't, you know, impede. Let's say that fire, and I hope I'm getting to what the comment was, because maybe I'm not. Let's say that fire extinguisher. Well, what's the use? We want to be able to get to the fire extinguisher if we need to and take it from the wall. So we want to make sure that we don't have something that is underneath it that's so tall that it would impede getting to it and using it the way that we should. So that planter, let's say we were going to put there, I would have the planter that goes from the floor, I would say, to less than the 27 inches. Wouldn't you say so, Mike? I wouldn't want it to get into that 27 to 80. But it just needs to be kind of like high enough and wide enough that a cane sweep would pick it up. But you certainly don't want to put something and wedge it right underneath that fire extinguisher where now we can't get the fire extinguisher off the wall. And you know, I think a lot of that is common sense. You know, keeping in mind what's the fundamental reason that we have this here and then not impeding with that. In my other guide that was more extensive, I had pictures of drinking fountains. Drinking fountains can be common protruding objects. They, you know, came from the wall in this building and they weren't quite built the way they should have been. And so the drinking fountain was impeding into the accessible route. Well, there, you in that instance, you would want to put your detect something for the cane sweep on either side of the drinking fountain, not right underneath it, because then someone in a wheelchair couldn't pull up and get a drink. So think about what's the use. How is this object being used if it's something that does need to be used, and to make sure that you're not taking care of one barrier and creating other barriers in doing so.
Yep.
Did you concur, Mike? Did I make that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. That was the point of the comment. So thank you for addressing that.
Okay,
and also,
great.
Something really quick is that you can have an object that may be detectable from one direction down a hallway, but it's not detectable from another direction. So,
looking
at it from both sides.
Thank you very, very much, because that's critical.
Like all right.
We trip all the east-going people, and the west-going are just fine.
Right.
not our goal.
No. All right. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour, so I apologize that we did not get to all of the questions. We'll look at the questions that were submitted and we weren't able to get to and see what we can do with all of those. As a reminder, today's session is being recorded. The archive, along with the handouts, will be available, and at some point in approximately 2 weeks, we'll get an edited edited transcript of today's session posted. So,
Go
ahead, Julie.
One thing I'd like to say is whenever I put a presentation together, then as far as I'm concerned, that PowerPoint now belongs to the individuals that, you know, listen to it. So when it's available, I have no problem with people taking any or all of this and using it for your own purposes to help you in what you're doing. And that means also if you're taking parts of it and creating your own PowerPoint or using it to, as a basis of fact sheets or handouts or whatever, this is now your information to help you do what you need to do. So thanks.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Julie. Just a quick reminder that April 21st will be our next ADA audio conference session where we will dive in depth into accessible parking. So you can get information on registering in the description of that session by visiting ada-audio.org, or you can give us a call at 877-232-1990 if you have questions about that. Again, thanks to Julie Brinkoff for her presentation today. Thanks for Mike Edwards for pitching in there, both with the Great Plains ADA Center, and thanks to everyone for joining us here today. So that will be a wrap for today's session. Wish all of you have a wonderful remainder of your Tuesday. Thanks for joining us, and take care.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.